was you in the credits then. You were the inspiration.
On that note, welcome.
I'm Gavin Moore.
Welcome.
Did you just call it the Game of Love?
Game of Love.
I called it Game of Owns.
I can't tell you. Like, welcome. Game of Love is what I heard.
That's welcome to Game of Owns, everyone. We're closer to Halloween than we were before. Thank you for listening this week.
We are closer to Halloween, which means true. 1 week closer to dressing up as Brienne. Isn't that what I was tasked with?
Now, can I just say something? By popular demand, we have a number of emails that come our way sometimes. People that are new listeners that are having trouble discerning our voices from one another. So just for everyone listening, just to clear it up, my name is Kate. I'm Kate. Welcome. Thank you for listening.
I'm Hot Pie.
Yeah, you are.
No one else has names,
God,
apparently.
Thank you. Your name is not Kate. My name is Kate.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up.
The rest of you guys are interchangeable. It's Kate and generalized men. As far as I know, there's like 25 of you.
It's true. It's just me and Kate, and I do different voices. You ready to hear my Eric voice?
Yes.
Hey, guys. Theon rocks.
Wow.
Here's my Micah voice.
What's up, guys? How you doing?
That was amazing. What I'm actually impressed with is that you guys jumped on that bit so fast.
Yeah.
You guys were instantly on board.
Pretty sharp.
We've had some time together. No, that's Mike and Eric. We're all best friends with each other. Thanks for listening.
That's it. We're done.
Oh, and sometimes we read books.
This week, a special treat. We have an incredibly long and cold and frozen Jon Snow chapter.
So. Drone Snow.
We have a Jon Snow chapter and a Sansa Stark chapter. And I actually did a little Google image search, and it wasn't on the first page. It was on the second page.
Well,
there's
done.
This cake of Jon Snow. You know, the second page of Google really does yield some still relevant and sometimes quirky results. Yeah. Don't always go with the first page. This has been your PSA.
So, Jon Snow.
John.
Let's talk some snow, some drone snow. This chapter was large, but I think it was appropriate that it was large because this chapter spent quite a lot of time demonstrating the scope of the Wildling army, and scope is massive.
Yes.
This is like the establishing shot of a giant army that's miles and miles long in text form, and he does a really, really good job of making you understand not only how massive the army itself is, but how massive the actual participants are. We've got descriptions of these giants that are just like even the mammoths that they're riding, they turn their head and their tusks go over Jon Snow's head. So like, you know that the bottom of the tusk is taller than Jon, and then
horse.
There's a giant riding on top of that. Like that, just like the massive, the scope of that is so well described. You can absolutely get a mental picture of it.
And I feel like I'm properly worried for the Seven Kingdoms now. I mean,
yeah.
I was during the show when they were talking about just the sheer number.
True.
And I knew that there were giants and things, and I knew that there were other disciplines and different kinds of people from different regions of the North that brought their own threats to the air quotes civilized cultures of people that get their bodies fitted for dresses, of which we'll find out more later. But in this chapter, serious fear has gripped me because I know that there's a lot of untrained people, but I think that Faramir Sixkins, he has the respect of his mount and of also the beasts that follow his mount. So he has the respect of more than just the beast he rides. Just people like that decorating their army. It's a pretty good job, man. It's a pretty good job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he describes these just like in vague terms, he gives you these specifics, these the giants and the actual people who are like lieutenants in this wildling army that have names. But then he gives you these vague descriptions of dudes who are riding in chariots made of walrus bones that are like being drawn by dogs. He's just like, here's the crazy stuff. And then here's like the real weird fringe stuff that we don't even know that much about. We only see them every once in a while.
George is like, I don't even know much about these people.
I'm going to give these people from the, look, they come from the way, way north. They come from the way, way northwest.
Yeah.
Areas where people should probably not be living or be able to survive.
Right. Why not?
Who would voluntarily live amongst the Frostbanks?
Santa.
You know, this is so obviously.
Santa. Yeah, well, I just think that what I mean to say is that they're that much more hardened because of it. You know, if you can survive in a place where there's pretty much no game either, no, you know, nobody for you to hunt. I mean, you wonder why some of these other northernly clans turn to cannibalism, but I mean, there's not much that can survive up there in frigid temperatures.
It's true.
I would imagine.
Yeah. Why even leave then? You know, that was one of the questions I had, is because these groups of people, they might even be safe, for lack of a better term, from the White Walkers, right? Because the White Walkers are supposedly headed south. So if you have these groupings of people that are already accustomed to living in the brutal cold and they're able to find a way to sustain, why even join up with Mansraider? What's the value?
Well, that, I think, is something that this chapter underscores really well, which is it's Mance's own persuasive skills that have caused these people to leave their comfort zone, every single one of them. There's a line in here about him, you know, he swayed some people with song and others with the edge of his sword. It's like he found common ground. And in the show, it's oversimplified, I feel. In the show, he's like, well, he told, what did he say to John? He says, I told them that they were all coming for us or whatever, and then he got them all to unite because the common enemy they shared is the White Walkers. Michael, what you're saying is that if they just stay put, the White Walkers wouldn't have been able to bother them because they're pretty secure or whatever, but I think that ultimately south, there is something, there's some ultimatum or some alternate reason for them to be going south. I don't know what it is. I mean, you might think that they'd find it to be too warm too, because they're used to, for generations, thousands and thousands of years, they've lived up north. They may not, I don't think they're going there for the warmer weather.
Isn't the implication that the men south of the wall have forced the free folk to live north of the wall and never come out? Like, it's sort of like a prison. So they're like, we want to take back the lands where we're related to the first men. We should be able to live in this world that's abundant.
So it's a claim to land. I feel like that would affect the people closest to the wall on the north side of it. You know, like, but like people who live in the way, way north, like the Frostfangs, probably weren't displaced from south of the wall. Although, I mean, there are some people who could see it like as a birthright.
I think, Eric, you answered the question really when you said how Mance was able to persuade them. Some with song and some with sword, and it doesn't really matter at the end of the day if they really wanted to go or not. It seemed like Mance is a very persuasive person, so he was able to rally them to his cause. So
yeah, but I know you bring up a good point though too, which is that if the White Walkers are heading south, why are the Wildlings moving south too? Why don't they just, Joe? But you know, at least in this chapter, maybe the answer is that they too fear the wild White Walkers and want to somehow find a way to put a stop to them. Because I mean, I know at the end of this chapter, when they come upon the remains of some of the Night's Watch garrisons, that, you know, they seem to, they double their patrols. They have to stay on the lookout for the White Walkers. They do not want to encounter the White Walkers, even with as many numbers as they have. They're a little spooked, or at least on their guard for where that army is. And I think that may give a clue as to why, you know, because ultimately they need to, I don't know, it's their problem as much. It's everybody's problem. The White Walkers are everybody's problem.
Yeah, the White Walkers can't get south, theoretically, any different way from the Wildlings. And they are just kind of like, the White Walkers are coming more often is what it seems like. They're attacking more often. So the Wildlings may just be sick of that. They're like, they're just preying on us. If we can get through the wall and disperse, then there will be more people for the White Walkers to fuck with that aren't us.
It's probably a lot like the different motivations that Mance used to unite these people. I think that they probably have a good handful of reasons between, you know, all of the split parties. I think that one of the strongest to me was when the song was started between Tormund and Ygritte, and they were yelling, or they were all singing, and eventually the entire war band started striking the song together, and it was just a big chanting mess of these awesome people cloaked in inverted sheepskin. And the song is essentially about the small folk usurping or superseding the giants, and I'm assuming that even to them, that's an older disgust that they're now just having to work in. Sort of almost like the Native Americans, where it's like, well, you know, the newer cultures kind of have a stronger claim and they have like more recent complaints. But really, if you track back even centuries earlier, there are different problems and it all kind of stems from the same thing. But in this case, even the giants are rolling with them. So I think that kind of just paints a broad context of being united and just a general disgust for people that are turning their nose up at them.
Yeah, and Igrit definitely has that sense of empathy when she's crying at the end of singing the song about the giants being lost.
Yep.
There's the free folk, they ride with who they want, they follow who they want, they don't have a leader in any official capacity, but there is a sympathy that exists between the different races. So although they are kind of like all in it for themselves, I think that their concern extends to others as well. There is that kind of like, we all need to protect each other because we're going to get wiped out.
And I think that George does. I think that's like obviously what he's intending in writing all of this too, is that there's a lot that is appealing in these chapters to the wild folk. I mean, John struggles this whole chapter with chastity, and that's something that none of these guys have any regard for. Like they just don't care. Like it's not an issue for them. Like John is having to sleep with his wolf to kind of rebuff and get out of making moves on well, protecting Ygritte's honor, I guess is what he would say. But it's like when Tormund confronts him, he doesn't get it, and a lot of these issues that we're seeing that Jon have with the vows that he took and stuff just doesn't exist up north of the wall. I mean, when Ygritte chooses to ride with him, for instance, and we know that she just wants to follow him, but she's allowed to. She's just like a free woman, goes where she wants. And it's not this huge issue, whereas in the Night's Watch, you know, John is stationed where he's stationed. He can't abandon his brothers on one side of the mountain because he wants to go to the safer side or anything like that. Like, he can't do any of the stuff that the free folk can do. And I think there's something very romantic. There's something very appealing about how free the free folk actually are.
Yeah. Oh, they're free.
I think, they're it's a theme throughout this chapter. And I think you really see that in Tormund and the stories that he tells and the relationship he has with Mag the Mighty, that he's just throwing jokes around with a giant and they're having a grand old time. And
we have to read that, Michael.
We will have to read that.
I love how there are giants though, and then like there are the giants that John thinks he knows from Nan's stories, and then there are these giants who are like more like bears, and they're not even wearing any clothing. They're just covered in hair head to toe, and their arms are long, and their feet are thick.
Well, so was Tormund, but that's part of his story.
Yeah. That is part of his story. Should we read this? What's the...
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, not just him, and we can read his story in a second, but it's also, you know, Rattleshirt, it's also Ygritte, it's also Varamyr, all these characters, you really have them developed in this particular chapter. Like, you get insight into who they are from a personality standpoint. Some are good, some are not good. And even Mance towards the end of the chapter, you see why people respect him and why he comes across as being such a strong leader in the positions that he takes with Jon.
So clearly here, the king or the leader of the giants is riding by on his, clearly the king or the leader of the mammoths.
Yeah, and so Jon turns to Tormund and asks him, what did you say to him? Was that the old tongue? And he responds by saying, I asked him if that was his father he was forking. They look so much alike, except that his father had a better smell. I kind of made him like half pirate. I don't know why.
No, he's good. That's good. That's good.
I liked it.
Pirates are free folk.
And what did he say to you? Tormund Thunderfist cracked a gap-toothed smile. He asked me if that was my daughter right in there beside me with her smooth pink cheeks. It may be he never saw a man without a beard before.
I like how John just like does not react.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not going to take issue with that.
John and Tormund was my favorite part of this chapter. And there was so much to love. I mean, it was lengthy and it did go on, but at the same time, just, you know, like first off, just seeing the joke get bellowed at him and sort of getting barked back. And this whole time you're seeing the chapter through, I think a really kind of, you can tell George is in a good mood when he wrote this. There's a few asides.
He's probably drunk, to be honest.
There's a few, right? There's a few parentheticals. There might be one. I might be, there's definitely at least one parenthetical. And he's just having a good time with it because John is very like wondery eyed while seeing all this happen. And he's himself in a, I think, in a great mood, which is kind of strange because we know what mission he's on from the Half Hand. But he is just in awe and he really likes Tormund and he likes riding with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was a little disturbed by Tormund's completely fabricated story about kidnapping and raping a woman who turned out to be a bear that he like tore the skin off of because he thought it was her jacket, essentially.
Yeah.
And then how like later there's these
half Tormund, half bears. Yeah.
Little man bears running around.
Well, that's one of his names from the previous chapter when he gets introduced. Father of Bears.
Yeah, I understand that.
But it has to be true. It's his name. It's.
I don't think so. He goes through all of these names that he has and he's like, these are bullshit, but they're my names.
Yep.
So what are you gonna
do? Do you believe the story about Giant's Bane then or Giant's Babe?
Giant's Babe.
Yeah. He's the one who says it was made up.
Well, he says he didn't kill the giant, but that's because he developed affection
that.
For her.
No, he put in a few qualifiers there. He was like, well, it makes you believe the rest of the story just a little bit more because he like gave up. He was just like, well, technically I didn't kill, but it has, he goes, Giant's Bane has a better ring than Giant's Babe, and that's the truth of it.
He had a little bit of Robin Aaron syndrome.
Well, he says this to John, and this is the point where I was reading and I just lost it. He says, there's times I still miss the taste of Giant's milk, though. It's like such a because he essentially survived this terrible storm, though not the worst storm he would face, by living inside a giant who then took him to be your kid. I mean, this is just weird shit, but you don't know enough about the North to know that it couldn't possibly happen.
Right.
So I'm like, well, okay.
I think you're like intended to believe that nothing he's saying
nothing.
Is true. Like it's all bullshit. He says that the bear bit off half his dick.
Yeah.
And then when John was like, but if you found the bear again, what'd you do? You don't have any more dick. You have half a dick.
No,
and he's
dick
like,
left.
My half dick is twice as big as yours.
Oh, that makes
like,
sense.
It's just like, I think that's like the perfect punctuation mark to all of this bullshit. Like, it's just like, okay, clearly you're super full of it. You're entertaining.
Isn't it the Lord of Bones later who's like, I'm going to prick you with this sword and watch you deflate all that air shoots out of you, buddy?
The best part about all this, though, is that could you imagine this conversation happening in King's Landing or Winterfell? No, and that's the best part of it is that these are free folk. The fact that you have somebody like Tormund tossing jabs back and forth with a giant and they're not ripping each other's heads off. Like imagine Jaime or anybody else walking side by side with a giant. It's just not going to happen.
Bronn, Tormund, Giant's Bane.
Oh, wow.
And Dolores Ed walking to a bar.
I would pay to sit in that bar for the night and drink.
They walk into the inn at the crossroads. Oh God!
But
mirth
then,
what happened? Mirth.
Of course, then shit gets real because Tormund starts asking John about Ygritte.
Yeah,
man.
Well, what do you think, Kate? Is she on the right track? Girl advice.
Ygritte is like okay. John is probably the least insane person that Ygritte maybe has ever met in her entire life.
Mm-hmm.
He is not like trying to steal her and rape her like apparently the free folk like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he has respect for her battle prowess. He seems like a nice guy. And it's Jon Snow. Like, of course, everybody's in love with Jon Snow. They're about the same age. It's good. It works. I think that Ygritte is on the right path. But it is interesting that she saves his life later in this chapter, basically. Essentially, she saves his life by lying about the fact that they've had sex, which they have not.
Yes. But that also, at the end, it works in her favor because it solidifies, like, now he owes her something. Like, I think that's how she's able to finally break his honor, like, to break him down into sleeping with her because he's not going to do it. I mean, they sleep together to stay warm, kind of, but there's a big old direwolf in between them. I mean, we're meant to believe that that has actually happened,
he's
right?
He's fluffy. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
and I don't, it's not that, I don't think John's trying to keep her away so much as he's trying to ward off his own temptation. He really wants to give in to this girl's seduction, and that she just thinks it's a natural thing that they should be having sex. And he's like, yep, that sounds right to me, but I've made all these vows and I probably shouldn't do that because I'm still a man of the Night's Watch. And this is in a lot of ways symbolic of his struggle about whether or not he's becoming one of these people or whether he admires them enough to adopt their culture. And as we've seen in the show, he sort of straddles that line a lot,
yeah,
because he does fall in love with the Grit and he does have loyalty to these men.
We spent so much time, or we have spent time, I should say, talking about John and his lineage and whether or not Ned is really his father. But this is a moment, or at least in this chapter, right? I feel like the honor really shines through, like the loyalty factor, you know, the oath that he's sworn to the Night's Watch. And I don't know if it's more just youth, and some, you know, being a bit naive as opposed to being truly honorable. But I feel like that quality really kind of comes through in this chapter, especially when he's having the conversation with Tormund and he's so scared about possibly sleeping with Ygritte, that he talks about fathering a bastard.
Yeah, that's something he really cares about, that too. He does not want to bring a child in the world who would be a bastard, and I feel like that's part of Catelyn's due to Catelyn's mistreatment of him, right? I mean, it has to be, he feels like a Stark. There are moments in this chapter, as you said, Micah, where he brings up, like, I may not have all their blood in my bones, but I still want to protect the North because it's my home, kind of thing.
But Tormund responds, you know, by saying to John, you know, you're a bastard yourself. Are bastards weaker than other children, more sickly, right, more like to fail? And I feel like that's included there for a reason, especially because here we are dealing, the whole chapter is about, you know, somebody who is a bastard, and we all know and hope that he goes on to do these really great things. And who knows, at the end of the day, he may not in fact be a bastard, but that's a story for another time.
I think in general too, there's this misunderstanding that Tormund has and that any other wildling really would too, possibly including Ygritte, which is, he asks her, what fools you kneelers be? Why did you steal the girl if you don't want her? And he said, steal? I never. And he says, you did. You slew the two she was with and carried her off. What do you call it? So there's this expectation that John would complete his capture of her in this indicated way. And that hasn't happened, because of John's, you know, differing views and his vow. But the wildlings all want it to happen. Tormund wants it to happen. I mean, he's just sitting as casually as he was talking to the giant. He's talking to John now about what he, how he feels about Ygritte. And it's a good thing that Tormund is not in the tent at the end of the chapter, or that could have ruined Ygritte's lie.
That's true. Although I kind of feel like Tormund would have kept his mouth shut the way he's taken up for John when Orel was pecking at him. You know,
Orel, man.
I don't know. I feel like Tormund's kind of taking a shining to John too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was done much different in the TV show. Obviously, it made sense there, but the fact that Orel is already dead, at least in human form, and is still coming back to haunt John, trying to rip his eye out, is...
That was quite a way to get his attention.
He gets summoned by Mance because Mance finds the remains of the Night's Watch, their setup. There's a bunch of dead horses, dead men everywhere, and he can tell by the numbers of men that he sees that John was lying to him about how many men were waiting for them. So Mance is pissed.
Yeah.
And he summons John. He's like, all right, you have about 10 seconds to not tell me a lie right now, or I'm going to totally kill you and I don't even care. So he interviews John about other facts about who's at the wall, who was at this slaughter, who was commanding. So he knows the old bear's dead. Who's commanding the wall now? And John tells him very honestly gives him answers to all these questions because he keeps repeating to himself, this is what the Half-Hand told me to do. This is my mission. I'm supposed to do whatever is asked of me and go like deep cover in the Free Folk. Yeah. And so he's doing it. He's telling Mance all this information and it's killing him. It's ripping him apart. Mance is still not super sure about old John, even after getting all this information. He's like, he just doesn't feel like he trusts him. And Rattleshirt wants to kill John for having lied about this kind of important fact about how many men were there.
I want me some crow bones.
Kind of important.
Yeah. And Ygritte saves his life. She stands in front of John. She stands up to Rattleshirt. She's like, you can't get mad at him. Rattleshirt's like, he's still a crow. He's going to betray us. And Ygritte says he's not going to betray us because he and I are totally boning. Like every night, like four or five times a night.
All the time.
And the wolf. Sometimes the wolf joins.
We're going to go bone right after this. This is
the
just
wolf
what we
does
do.
Not join.
Yeah, but for Mance, I mean, he's in a tough position. And I think John, you know, he thinks a number of times about actually taking out Mance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he feels basically if you cut the head off of the snake, right? Or whatever you want the monster to be. That's it, right? And that's what's so scary about this group of wildlings. Mance is the one unifier. And if you get rid of him, it's just mass chaos after that. None of these people are disciplined enough to follow anybody else. You know, they may have these little, I'll call them troop leaders, right? Your Tormunds and your Varamirs and your Lord of Boneses. But at the end of the day, if Mance falls, everybody's going to disperse and go in their own separate direction because nobody's going to mm-hmm. want to follow anybody else.
That's a theory yeah. that John has, but I don't know. I mean, they're already in motion though. They have, I mean, I think that at this point, wouldn't their momentum, you know, kind of not be, I mean, if they get into a big war, sure. But if John were to just kill Mance now in this tent, would they really turn back after how far they've come? I mean, we're talking about years of kind of, Mance going around getting these people to head south from where they live.
What we learned about the way their host is working is that they're essentially sending most of their badasses, or at least a strong handful of them, on a constant perimeter scan, just making sure that people are moving, kind of, you know, barking orders in several languages to make sure that it all does stay together. And I think that Mance Raider's brilliance and just skill, which John does point out in this chapter when he says in many different ways, other than just being called a king, Mance is a king.
Yeah.
Just knowing all of this about him, I really do believe that no matter how far that they are, knowing that what we do about their perimeter and knowing what we do, again, John talks about it in this chapter, about their lack of discipline, even now with their great intimidating numbers and impressive people, yada, 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 still, it's going to take the unification underneath a banner, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think that if he did die, I think that they would still be together, but I definitely think that the Seven Kingdoms united or even divided / sort of united would have a really good chance at picking off these people that I'm sure would kill probably at least half of each other before all is said and done.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, John says that, well, he expects the Night's Watch to still be alive at the Fist, you know, which is his first mistake, because it just turns out to not be the case. But he hypothesizes that they could set the North back 100 years, that it would not, that they'd be, if they kind of put a dent in these forward marching guys from north, that they could, that it'd be 100 years before they were a real serious threat again. And that's just by John's own estimation. And I think that speaks to how many people he sees walking, you know, on foot without horses, mm-hmm. and how many, and his, views of, you know, everybody's inner organization, which we get much later in the show. You know, when he kind of thinks it at the last minute, then when the battle's upon the wall, but here we get it, gloriously well in advance.
And it really is intimidating.
Yeah. I mean, friggin' giants that are more like animals than humans. I don't know. Just the description of the giants got me. And that was like in the very beginning of the chapter.
I've just grown to appreciate Mance Raider so much over the course of this chapter.
He's really
cool. And lots in the last chapter as well, knowing what he's done. But, and this is just a factoid and a featurette among part of what he is. But he does speak the old tongue, which is kind of cool. And he sings in the old tongue. So just imagine this guy playing his lute and just showing off while he's the king of all of these crazy people. That's what he does. That's what he's doing. And when he's standing at the Fist of the First Men, when they make their way through the defensive measures that you see the Men of the Night's Watch did, and they make it through the just disgusting, what we've come to know visually from the show, the way the White Walkers decorate the dead bodies in a way that makes it known that no one else could have done this, because they would have made use of either the things on them or their meat for staying alive, or their hides for warmth, etc. Once they make it through all of this, and John joins Mance after being summoned by Rattleshirt, he's just standing there with his slashed red cloak. And I just, after reading the whole chapter and it leading up to this, I just feel like this dude was emanating power and I didn't even see him. I was just like, this guy has got his stuff together. I thought it was very well done.
And he's just observant. There's no supernatural aspect to Mance Rayder, but he knows what John is thinking at all times. I mean, John is thinking about, Mance is like coming towards him asking, who led here? And he stepped closer, and it says in the book, one more step, thought John, another foot. He moved his hand closer to Longclaw's hilt. If I hold my tongue, and then Mance says, reach up for that bastard sword, and I'll have your bastard head off before it clears the scabbard. I am fast losing patience with you, Crow. I mean, he cuts right to the heart of it and says, look, you gotta tell me now. And if you answer, if he says at one point, if you answer another one of my questions with a question, you're done. Like, it's just, dude, tell me this. I don't trust you anymore.
John is clearly out of his league.
Super hot water too. Yeah.
Which is why he tells no lies, because man, Mance is sharp. He needs to stop underestimating people.
Now, it's a good thing, I guess, that there wasn't more tactical information that John could have divulged, or like maybe they weren't asking as many questions as they could have asked John to get more information about seizing the wall, but I guess that's all forthcoming.
Well, Mance knows so much already.
That's true, yeah.
Knowing who's commanding, because he tells Mance when he asks who was in charge here, and he eventually tells him Old Bear. He just assumes Old Bear to be dead, which I'm assuming, again, the show handled things in a different way, and I'm not sure what's going to happen in the book. But so Mance then, okay, well, who's leading back at the wall? And John tells him Bowen Marsh. So from there, Mance laughs and he goes, if so, our war is won. Bowen knows a deal more about counting swords than he's ever known about using them. So I feel like he's confident enough not even to have to worry. So
his next
order, which is sending John in a small packet, a force to climb the wall for scouting and et cetera that we don't know about yet. I feel like that he's confident enough that this is his next smart move, and to keep moving the army toward the wall, because he knows that if there were 300 people, and then he's counting the horses here and the horses they saw in the tree line just off, there were survivors and they hope to catch them before they reach the wall. So it's cool. He's really smart and he's tactically putting this all together really well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think he's a great tactician, especially towards the end of the chapter.
Eric, can we refer to your cake to know what to do next?
Yeah, they're both in a cake. So there's this cake that was posted on our social media, Twitter and Facebook, and one half of it is Jon Snow, and the other half of it is this little redhead who's in a nice dress, and it's Sansa Stark.
Is it a new gown?
I'm not sure. It looks more like a like an elaborate bathrobe or something.
It looks more lovely than I've ever worn.
That's true. My lady. That's true.
This chapter makes me sad because...
Why?
Because she clearly is absorbing the experiences that she's had, these terrible experiences with Joffrey and the Queen, and she is reflecting those experiences onto the young ladies of the court that she's meeting from the Tyrell army of ladies. And she's like meeting them, and they're all this like giggly, Twitter-pated. Mm-hmm. They're very much the songbird that she used to be. And she's reflecting on that too. She's like, she's envious of them, because she pities them and she envies them because they're so naive. And this entire chapter is her being fucking naive still.
Yeah, she reverted back, basically, didn't she?
She has. She's like, she considers herself to have all of this terrible knowledge of court, but she's doing the same stuff she always does. She's trusting people too much. The queen is very suspiciously giving her a bunch of new clothes. She doesn't even think to second guess it. What has she learned? She has learned nothing.
Just I choose a kind of softer interpretation of this chapter for Sansa, and it's only a couple pages. No, I'm just saying, like, I feel she is between places right now, right? She's not going to be the badass game player that we know her to become eventually, or at least, well, I think she's still making her way there in the show. But, you know, she has had these traumatic experiences, and God, this is the first time that she can kind of afford to maybe let her guard down a little bit. She's got Margaery Tyrell, who calls her sister now, and they're going in there, they're running in the gardens, and she, you know, for the first time, she feels kind of looked after and protected by people who don't seem all that bad. That doesn't mean they're not bad, but at least for the love of God, they're not decapitating family members in front of her. And it's finally, it's just a breather. And I think that's why this chapter was so short too. It's like, it's meant to show us that, like, things are kind of, I mean, obviously nothing like exciting is happening, but it's still just a breather for Sansa. Like, she needs this. Everybody needs this. There's always a longing, I think, I feel anyway, to go back to a time of innocence and a time of childhood. And I don't really blame her for taking a few days off and kind of doing that with these nice girls who are like cousins or whatever. And like, they're playing kissing games of running through the forest. Like, I just think that level of innocence is something that you only have once and you should get it while you can.
Yeah. I mean, you're right, Eric. You're definitely right. I mean, in a perfect world, our friend Sansa Stark, the lady, is having a great time, you know? And I will say that I was happy for her when she was out hawking with Marjorie.
Yeah, she's
does that not
That's
sound
awesome.
Fun, guys?
That's awesome.
They're like, it did. They walk outside the city. They've got all of these grown men that are, their full-time job is to make sure that no one hurts these young girls. And so they're just like the sort of like the, I guess the equivalent, I'm not very good on pop culture. So are the Kardashians still cool? Are they, Micah?
I don't know the answer to this.
You live in New York.
That's the only reason I'm asking.
Yeah, I live
laughing.
In New York. sure.
Okay, well. Listeners at home, insert a name. Like they're watching
Taylor
these girls,
Swift.
And it's I know she's a career woman. They take a ferry across where a battle was just had not too long ago, and yeah. There's still smoldering wreckage. And they go to the Kingswood for their own personal day of hawking. They're cheering on Peregrine Falcon. They're cheering on a hawk. Like yes, I'm glad she's having this great mirthful time. But Kate is exactly right. Like it's a massive, massive step back. And what's been going on. This is something Arya would never let slip her mind, no matter what kind of dress she was getting fitted for.
She would never get
fitted for a dress.
Yeah.
She wouldn't let
but
it
if
happen.
If she had to get fitted for a dress, she'd sit through it and she'd get fitted. But the whole time she'd be like, all right, what the shit is Cersei trying to make me do? I'm going to pay attention to stuff real close from now on, especially when it has to do with Cersei, that bitch.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing is that Sansa does her duty in a way by warning Margaery again about Joffrey. But Margaery is so convinced that it's not an issue. And I feel like that also helps to get Sansa in the mood where she's more innocent and more naive and more complacent. And the issue that Dantos brings up, later in the chapter to Sansa is that, the Tyrells have their own agenda with her. And that's kind of the issue. That's kind of why they're being so nice to her. And she doesn't really see that yet. But I think what's going on for her is, you know, she tried to warn Margaery that Joffrey's a monster, but Margaery says, don't worry about it. We're fine. And also Loras is in the Kingsguard. So he's awesome and we'll be protected and nothing bad could possibly happen. That's helping to let her guard down. That's helping to, I mean, she would, I think, if she weren't, if Margaery was like, oh yeah, tell me more. That's scary. Like Sansa would be in that head space where she could, you know, be more of a good assistant to help Margaery deal with it. But because Margaery is saying, don't worry about it, go have fun with all these girls, like, and she's picking up needlework again, like all this stuff is like because she's been told not to worry about it. Nobody's relying on her to really be this great tactician at this moment, and she appears to not be in much danger. The queen who she thinks would want to kill her is making her a dress.
But they want her to be docile. That's what we're meant to see when Dantos is speaking to her and us, and he's like, listen, remember your claim. Like, I feel like that's the juxtaposition within this chapter.
Yeah.
And again, that is why it's so short, because it's a snippet and it's meant to say something and it's meant to remind us, and it's meant to remind her. And I think it did that. And I think that she has been reminded. And I think that we kind of leave the chapter sort of feeling that way, feeling a little, I know that I certainly did, feeling a little cross toward Marjorie. Even though I'm sure she has great intentions, she is a lot like the Queen of Thorns.
Yeah. There were a couple of things in this chapter that stood out to me, even though it was a pretty short one. There's the mention again of the fact that the Hound kissed her. She's continuously playing this back in her mind. And so you have to wonder how much of that night does she actually remember? How much of it that we experienced when we read A Clash of Kings was actually real? You know, it's hard to tell at this point, because from what we read, that never happened. He never in any way forced himself upon her. But yet, this is at least the second time right now that we're going through in A Storm of Swords, and this has been mentioned.
She's brought it up.
And then one other thing that's mentioned in here that I thought could be her ultimate undoing, and I think was one of the reasons why this chapter was written, and it really, as you guys mentioned, has shown the strong ties that have developed between Marjorie and Sansa. Sansa actually recalls that she told Ser Dantos that she was going to Highgarden to marry Willis Tyrell. Now, we all know that there are people out there who have plans for Sansa that are tied to Dantos. So for her to slip this information to him probably was not the best plan.
It's like she's not acting wisely at all, despite all of her terrible experiences so far that should have taught her to be at least a little bit careful.
He's going to rescue her. He's going to save her and take her away. He's the actionable plan.
She is such an airhead. I'm sorry. Aww. I think that Sansa, listen, she's like 13. I understand being a 13-year-old girl is basically the worst for your sense of common sense. But I think that she's going to grow up to be a really like badass player like her mom. I think she's going to end up being very smart. She's just learning a lot of hard lessons right now. And it's frustrating as this omnipotent viewer of everything that's going on. It's frustrating to see her not learn a lesson, even though it's so important that she learn a lesson. Don't run your mouth. Don't trust the queen. Don't expect that marrying a lord of Highgarden is actually going to solve all your problems. This is exactly where you were at the beginning of fucking Game of Thrones.
Yep. What Kate's trying to say, everyone who can't understand her through her seething, she's saying, Hawking good, telling Dantos stuff bad.
I have a great deal. Like I said, she's a little girl. They treat these characters as though they are full-fledged adults and you read about them and you're an adult. And so it's hard to remember sometimes how incredibly young they are. And I understand it, but damn girl, how many times you got to learn this? When is it good? And I think the reason that she is being fitted for these clothes, as we know from the show, is that the queen is intending to betroth her to Tyrion.
That was my guess.
A wedding. Right. So she's intending to marry the king's uncle, which means that she needs new clothes. And that never crosses her mind.
No, something. She thinks it's because what Cersei doesn't want her to look too shabby at Joffrey's wedding, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, maybe Cersei just really wants Joffrey's wedding to go off without a hitch.
She's micromanaging everything.
She has an unpleasant surprise.
She's like, Sansa's clothes are too tight while we're at it. Get her done too. No, I don't like her. Just don't make it look too good. A little too big or something.
Oh, but how about the seamstress who's like got 12 serving girls and they're all going to stop what they're doing to make Sansa's dress? That should be a hint, right? I guess.
Yeah.
That should be.
Exactly.
This is the saddest part. This is the last paragraph of this. And she's talking, you guys just mentioned, that must be why Cersei is having it made for me, so I will not look shabby at the wedding. And then this paragraph just like plummets your mood down into the fucking toilet. And it says, she really ought to have a different gown for the feast afterward, but she supposed one of her old ones would do. She did not want to risk getting food or wine on the new one. I must take it with me to Highgarden. She wanted to look beautiful for Willis Tyrell. Even if Dantos was right, and it is Winterfell he wants and not me, he still may come to love me for myself. Sansa hugged herself tightly, wondering how long it would be before the gown was ready. she could scarcely wait to wear it.
Okay, when you read it, when you read it like that, I understand 100%.
That's how I read it.
I understand it 100% what you're saying. I get it. Now well, I'm maybe, frustrated too. Fuck this chapter.
There you have it. Sorry, George.
Oh, jeez. No, this chapter is great. I when I say that this chapter is frustrating and saddening to me, that's because it does such an incredible job of illuminating to you how naive Sansa is and how much she is still this little songbird, even though she thinks that she's wise to Joffrey's tricks. And, you know, she's like, oh, I don't know. She's so focused on when Joffrey is going to start abusing Margaery, because to her, I feel like maybe there's this sense that it's only the physical abuse that she suffered at Joffrey's hand that matters. And so the abuse, this like psychological abuse that she's suffered from the queen and from other people at court, it doesn't even seem to register to her as something that's unforgivable. But so much as Joffrey, you know, beating her and stripping her naked in front of everybody and all that stuff. Mm.
I just wish her the best. You know,
me too.
That's what she wants. She wants to be out of this situation.
I just want to scoop her up. Save her from all this.
Sansa, if you're listening, I don't care who knows it. I wish you the best.
Sansa, email us. Send us an email. We'll come get
contact
you.
At gameofones.com.
Thank you. Sansa, this is my phone number. Eric, please give it to her. Thank you.
5-1.
Don't do it. Let's own them all.
Own.
Mansa's got it.
He does.
He just owns so many different people, right? Ygritte tries to step up and talk for John by saying what happened to his face. He basically said, did I ask you? You know, shut up. Mm. You know, he owns John. You know, really throughout the last part of the conversation. And then he owns even the Magnar of Thin, right? When he's not happy that he has to take John along with him. He's like, he knows the watch and he knows the wall and he knows Castle Black better than any raider ever could. You'll find a use for him or you're a fool.
I mean, that's true. It's true. Have we come across someone this absolute? I mean, has George written a character that has had this strong of a personality without any two, you know, measurable flaws? I think that one measurable flaw in this chapter would be how easily he let John off when he found out that him and Ygritte were a thing, when he was like, well, I can't interrupt that. And he sort of let it go just after that. Like, is that a measurable flaw on his part? But the rest is, I don't know. He's killing it. It's kind of unnatural for this series.
Yeah.
For some reason, he really reveres that sexual bond between them.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like they're basically married. He's like, oh, well, okay, well, fine. You guys are in love, then.
So be it.
By all means. Yeah.
That's what I caught. I feel like I caught one kind of, and then there, and then everything else he was just destroying. So,
He's just the man in this chapter.
Well, if he's the man, Tormund's the baby. if we're giving owns, I'm going to give mine to Tormund. He did the old tauntaun trick. slice it open, crawl inside, stay warm.
Those innards.
Not quite Hoth, but it's still pretty bitter. So that's my own. Even if it never happened, right, Kate? Even if it never, ever, ever happened.
I think it happened.
Let's hope it never happened.
Oh. I believe him.
Bree is, she gets my own because she's, generally, I'm annoyed by Ygritte. Like, the you know nothing Jon Snow is a pretty infuriating catchphrase. But in this chapter, she more or less saves his life from Rattleshirt wanting to kill him. She lies for him, which she has no problem doing. And out of the whole deal, she gets what she's been wanting for a while, which is some of that Jon Snow D.
Yep. Yep.
Go, girl. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Which leaves Zach.
I don't even, honestly, there's an abundance of owns. I feel like I want to give it to Mag because he just came back. I don't know if he actually said that back to Tormund, but if he did, that was, he just like, oh, who's that? Is that your daughter? Right? liked about John. That's, so I want to give it to him because that's just that's something else. Because Tormund was like giving him shit for like, you know, your mammoth's ugly. So are you, buddy? How you been? I haven't seen you in a few days because I was riding somewhere else. And he's like, oh yeah, well who's that? That girl right there, it looks like a girl to me. It doesn't have a beard, must be a girl. So you get it.
And he's got a cool name, Magmar Tundowig, Mag the Mighty.
Yeah, not so bad.
Not so bad.
He's a good dude.
Oh gosh, you know, Kate, you were hating on Dantos earlier, but I feel like he imparts upon Sansa some of his own advice, which is useful. He says,
"Wait, when was I hating on Dantos?
I don't know. You just were." He says, "I tell you, these Tyrells are only Lannisters with
flowers."
You're
just making shit up now.
No, you weren't. You did not like the Dantos.
Quote
You're
me.
Like she should Quote not. Me. You said that Sansa should not be telling him this stuff.
That's not Dantos's fault. It is Dantos' fault.
Well, everything to do with that. His allegiance. Oh, it's Micah.
Kate. I know our voices are very
I know,
very
you're
close
so similar. You know what, Micah? Ever since you introduced yourself as Kate at the beginning of the show, I'm so confused. See, I've come to rely on our introductions of ourselves to learn who I'm speaking to every episode.
Man, you're killing it.
Do you think that was intentional or was that accidental?
Eric's killing it. I don't know. He's just killing it right now. Eric gets my own this chapter.
Eric, you can start your own over without fucking making accusations about shit I didn't say. How's that?
Okay, well, I know that Kate's favorite character ever is Dantos. Sir Dantos Hollard. I share that.
She's got a tattoo.
I share that feeling with her.
I do.
On lower
it's
back.
Like the heart shape. Yeah, it's my tramp stamp. My tramp stamp says Dantos.
I have one on the bottom of my foot that says Dantos.
Ooh, that's a painful spot.
It's only for me.
Okay, Eric, for you're me. Own. You're owning Dantos. Go, please go.
My own for Dantos. He gives Sansa some great advice. He says, I tell you, these Tyrells are only Lannisters with flowers. That is, there really can't be better advice than that. It's something that she doesn't quite consider, but when I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, wait. Oh, snap. They're malicious. Like, he even goes so far as to tell Sansa what their plan is for her, that they want her claim to Winterfell. So I don't think Dantos does any wrong yet. And I know that, or you guys know that in the show, I was like really hoping that he would be like a stand-up guy in the end and not have like shitty motives. But, I still want that for his book self. I still want him to be this good guy who has like this huge redemptive arc. So. I mean, Sansa saves his life, right? So he shouldn't betray that.
That's true.
But he owns for giving that. That's a great line. Making us think of the Tyrells, her benefactors, as being no better than the Lannisters.
I'm going to give my own to Margaery for knowing when Sansa brings up the deal. They're in the forest and they're kind of alone. And they're like, hey, our birds are killing a lot of stuff. And she's like, yeah, my bird killed more than yours, but you still have a good bird too. Sansa's like, and Joffrey's really bad. And she starts telling Margaery more bad stuff about Joffrey. And Margaery's like, listen, it's cool. We made a deal that before the wedding stuff even happened, Loras was named one of the Kingsguard. Loras being inducted into the Kingsguard, she's like, I'm all right because he'll be close by. And if any stuff goes down, you know, Joffrey's going to have a badass knight to answer to. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of what you were just saying, Eric, about how they're just Lannisters with flowers. Like, you know, we got a young up-and-coming knight being put into the Kingsguard. It sounds a little bit like someone that I knew before in another life. And I think that it's kind of similar. And I think that they are a lot like the Lannisters.
I have a question just occurred to me. We sort of hinted at the fact that telling Sir Dantos this information was a bad idea. What if Sir Dantos is making up this shit about them being Lannisters, like as bad as the Lannisters, because he knows that if he can't get her on that ship, Peter Baelish is not going to pay him whatever bounty he has offered him to rescue Sansa. And so he's just telling her whatever lies he can make up to make her change her mind about wanting to go to Highgarden.
That's the
impression I got. What if they're totally nice, wonderful, perfect people?
Who knows?
What if it's all a lie? What if they're not like Lannisters at all?
Well, either way, own to Margaery for having her ducks in a row and her badass brother.
And there are a lot of ducks in the lake.
We got ducks. We got hawks.
I don't have any owns for this chapter. My own goes to Sansa's hawk because it killed 3 ducks.
Yep.
And the only character
that's
that
how easy it is to give owns on this
I like
show.
Kate did not really have an own for this chapter, but I'll give it I will give it to the silver hair net that Sir Dantos brings up, which has gotten yet another mention prior to the purple wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep. Mm-hmm.
He instructs her very, very, very strictly to wear it, as I told you.
Which comes off as just really creepy when you don't know why. Sir Dantos is kind of, he's kind of creepy anyway, and he's kind of drunk, and he's just like, give me a kiss, little girl. Yeah, and here's a silver hairnet. It's just, it's very like, ooh, you're a little bit sketchy and creepy, Sir Dantos. So the fact that he's like insisting that she wear this gift, this very specific gift that he gave her to this wedding, and she's like, okay, I guess I will. Why? But you, I mean, you figure it out later, but it does paint him as just this creepy, like, kind of pedo uncle.
Listeners familiar with this show who have listened before know that after we get done doing our owns, we go to your owns. We segue on over. And today we have owns from Facebook and Twitter. Yay!
Both. Yeah, nicely done, Eric.
Yeah, well, over on Facebook we heard from Lonnie and Zavino, who gave us their own for both John and Sansa chapters. The John chapter own, she says, own for John 2 goes to Mag the Mighty for asking Tormund if John was his daughter. Yeah.
Yes, thank
you. Don't you love it when the listener owns, Zach, mirror your own owns?
Yeah, I do. I really do love it.
Let's see if I love it a lot. Let's see if she agrees with you on the Sansa chapter. Lana says, own for Sansa 2 is Tywin. Ooh, that's unexpected. Poor Sansa is still naive as ever, despite her inner monologue of worry for Marjorie. If the own has to actually appear in the chapter and Tywin is disqualified, my own goes to the stable boy who gets an eyeful helping her on the mount.
You can own whatever you want.
That's the truth. That's the truth. There are no rules in owning. I kind of have a self-imposed rule where I never give my own to the point of view chapter character, but, you know, that's just me. And none of my co-hosts on this podcast have chosen to honor that 100% of the time. Like I have Black Eyed Lily over on Twitter, Susan Stacy, our friend, ASOS, chapter 15, John Tormund owns all, tall talker, Giant's Bane, and husband to bears.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Stacy.
And in Sansa, Cersei owns Sansa through the age old desire for a young girl, new clothes.
Oh, Dobby is free.
This tweet comes from George R. R. Martin, who says Game of Owns, it gets my own for both of these chapters because they are such the great podcast.
Thanks, George. And
hashtag Sansa sucks.
we always love when he writes in. Here's a tweet from Miranda Gwynn. She says, all right, Game of Owns, you're running a half marathon with me tomorrow in San Francisco. Let's both bring our A game, shall we? Thumbs up emoji.
Gets a camel.
There's a camel emoji and a goat or a cow emoji. So I hope that you survived, succeeded, and hydrated. Miranda, thank you for writing
half marathon. Thank you for listening to us on your marathon. That's awesome.
Got an own here from our good friend Jeff Lightfoot. Right?
Yeah,
of the social studies department.
I'm throwing it.
Professor Lightfoot, right? Isn't it?
Yeah.
To you.
Dr. Lightfoot.
Dr. Lightfoot.
Sir or professor, please.
Mm-hmm.
The good professor says, John Owen goes to Ygritte. She is one of the few characters who plays no games, and you don't have to wonder what she is really up to. Quote, I never said when we started, find another place for ghosts to sleep tonight, Jon Snow. Mm-hmm.
Hashtag, I never said when we started, but I said when we gonna finish.
Well, just as Kate just did the hashtag Rose Leslie accent. So
very nice.
Yeah. That's my perfect Rose Leslie.
My favorite
impression.
Teacher. Teach me your ways.
And of course, Ram Dent gave us his own for the Jon Snow chapter. Own to Tormund for being the funniest character in the series and betting a bear. And own to everyone in King's Landing for creeping on Sansa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She's the object of everyone's game.
Inappropriate.
Ram Dent, own to you for playing that broken cymbal in your Twitter biopic.
Yeah, a piece of it like fell off. That's crazy.
It's because he's such a badass drummer.
He has the strength of 1,000 giants and shattered it with only one smack. Here's one from Nicole. She says, own for Jon and Sansa goes to Uncle Ray for the freaking giants and that amazing foreshadowing. to the Red Wedding.
You've heard from Facebook. You've heard from Twitter. Now hear from our email inbox.
It talks now?
It talks.
Oh.
And it takes on the voice of Erica Furman, who sent in for the John chapter. I give my own to Ygritte. She has John having so many stirrings. He has to keep repeating his vows to himself. Yeah, girl.
Not bad.
Mm-hmm. All right. As for the Sansa chapter, Marjorie got my own for being on her game when it comes to Joffrey. She says, quote, I shall have the finest knight in the Seven Kingdoms protecting me night and day, as Prince Aemon protected Nerys. So our little lion had best behave, hadn't he? End quote. She knows what it's like. Or she knows what he's like, and she isn't going to let him treat her as badly as he did Sansa. Keep up the greatness that is your podcast. We try, Erica. We try.
Our last email comes from Simon Amundsen, who I believe has written us every week for several weeks now. Thank you, Simon. He says, my own for John 2 goes to Varamyr Sixskins and his Snow Bear, Shadow Cat, and Three Wolves.
Yes!
Another warg. By just being in his presence, he made the terrified John quake in his boots. Hashtag the free folk. Hashtag we do not kneel. Thank you, Simon.
I also own to you for hashtagging in your emails. I actually like that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, email. That's you rarely see hashtags in emails.
How can people get in touch with us, folks?
Eric, you know how to do it, right?
I do know how to do it. On Facebook, simply go over to our Facebook page. There's a URL for it. It's called facebook.com/GameOfOwns. Or just search Game of Owns and we'll pop up. Our page will pop up. We currently have over 2,000 likes. Thank you for liking us on Facebook. And over on Twitter, twitter.com/GameOfOwns. That is the way to do it. At reply us at Game of Owns on Twitter. We currently have like 5,000 followers on there. So that's awesome.
Damn.
Thank you for doing that. And email. Yeah. The email inbox address is contact@gameofowns.com, and we currently have 128 spam emails. So thank you.
We do read and appreciate each of those emails, so thank you for your continued communication, those of you playing at home.
I also believe we're on the Instagram, right? For people who want follow us there, instagram.com/guess.
Game of Owns.
Oh,
all we do is post pictures of Kate making faces at the camera, so go like them up, people. I'm Kate.
That is not true.
There is another way you can get in touch with the show, and that is on iTunes, where we have 516 five-star ratings.
Yes!
Yay!
Wow.
Thank you, everyone.
And 284 customer reviews. So I guess you can rate and not necessarily review, but we do encourage that if you take the time to rate the show, you also leave us a review. We did get a great one here that I just want to share really quickly. It is from A-Hall. So Arsenio Hall, thank you so much. He was a listener of the show.
Big listener.
With the appropriate title of his review being Bone Down.
Yeah.
Hey-o.
After hearing I needed to check out this podcast, the Brothers Befuddled episode was my first. To say the least, it definitely got me in the mood to bone down. Mm. It's been a while.
Oh my God.
Your fault.
Please
Kate.
Continue.
Your fault.
It's been a while. I read the books, but they brought me right back to the chapters covered and got me thinking about specific scenes and interactions in a way I hadn't before. To go along with the great content, it's actually pretty hilarious. They have a solid dynamic. I'll definitely be listening to more. So we thank you, Arsenio, for writing in.
Thank you.
But really, iTunes is a great place for other people like A-Hall to find out about the show, and we appreciate that after listening to just one episode they were willing to go on and leave us a review, because it just helps spread the word that we're here, you know, in the 42 weeks in between seasons, that you know, we're able to provide you guys hopefully what you want to hear and take your feedback and, you know, communicate with all you fun people. So iTunes, it is the month of October still, the month of Halloween, so nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable.
Send us your photos of your best Game of Owns inspired Halloween costumes. If you dress up like me, I will get you a retweet.
Whoa!
Eric, way to sell yourself.
Will you retweet me?
Yeah, I'll retweet you.
All right, then.
So it's the elusive Eric Skull retweet.
Can we officially say, so going back to that iTunes review, Arsenio Hall decided that he wanted to bone down after listening to one single episode of our podcast. So does that make us like, are we a scientifically proven aphrodisiac?
It is known.
You know what happens at the end of the Prisoner of Azkaban credits? That's happening all over the world. All over the world for people listening to our show.
And if
you're wondering what Eric is talking about,
subscribe to us on Patreon. Oh, it's a perfect transition.
Exactly. Oh,
there's a beautiful story.
Yeah, well, I was about to make that transition.
Micah told a beautiful story
today. Since we're associating a numerical value, we've officially poured in 9 million man hours into chapter 2.
Yes.
More will be poured into it. Look forward to that this week. We're excited. And if you don't know what we're talking about, maybe you should head over to patreon.com/goo and get involved, because we make more than just this show for you. We make more.
Trust us. More secret, it's amazing.
Secret shows. This show, of course, will always be free. But if you want extra cool stuff, check us out on Patreon.
That's true. And speaking of free things, my excellent transition.
Yeah.
You may remember last week, a little video of a bunch of stuff.
I do remember that video, Zach. I do. That was a bunch of stuff. That stuff was bunchy.
Sorry, I've had a long weekend, and it's been fun. But it's going to become even more fun this week, because we have a very fun opportunity to reach out and touch a lot of you, almost physically. I'm going to be mailing out a lot of things with my hands here in the coming days to all of you that listen. So refer to the link in the show notes to have a video proof of all these things. But our friends at HBO have been very, very gracious and have sent over just a broad selection of niceties, all from the Game of Thrones universe. And it's going to be a reward for those of you who just love this series, who just love it so very much. And that's all we ask from you, is to write in to us anywhere on Watchers on the Wall, where we post our episodes, and you can comment on our Twitter account, where we tweet stuff, on our Facebook wall, in our email. Some of you may even have text message devices to us. Who knows? Anywhere you can communicate, tell us in however many words you would like, what is it that you love so much about this series? It can be specified to the book series. It can be specified to the TV series. It can be specified to particular people involved with either of those things. It is literally up to you. What we are doing with these things, we will tell you very soon. But in the meantime, prepare your best, eloquent, succinct, beautiful words of thanks, because this show and series has brought all of us together, including the four of us you hear right now, which we do every week, and it has become a very, very enjoyable part of our lives, and hopefully a very enjoyable part of your lives as well. So think about it and participate, because there's some pretty cool stuff that I'd love to keep all of it.
Zach, should they use a particular hashtag or keyword so that we can find these posts that are contest entries?
Glad that you mentioned that, Kate. We were thinking hashtag thank you, Game of Thrones.
That's good.
There are a limited number of items, numerous they may be. Mm-hmm. They are limited. Mm. So think of your time and use it wisely. We will be collecting and doing things over the next week and a half. But again, the items are limited. So keep your eyes peeled to our social media accounts if you want more information. This podcast is just part of what we do, guys. If you like it, pay attention.
Put a ring on it.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
So in addition to sending in those stories, as Zach mentioned, be sure to do your homework as well. We don't require much of you. We just give you a ton of stuff to do, obviously, before next week's show.
Gosh.
But read on with us in the book, In a Storm of Swords. Next chapters are Arya and Samwell. And it's always good to visit with those two. You never know what they're up to.
Well, this is our first time visiting Samwell, it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm excited, personally. I know that Sam is a frequent guest, though infrequent recently, on the show. He's appeared many times, and who knows, with us finally getting inside of his mind, perhaps we will find a way to bring him back. Get your owns together for those two chapters. You can send them to us any one of the ways Eric mentioned earlier, Twitter, Facebook, email. We look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you, everyone. This has been very fun.
Thank you. We'll see you all next
week. So much fun. We're going to do it again next week.
I'm Micah. Thank you.
This joke is never going to get old.
I'm Kate.
It is the world's best joke.
I'm You're Zach.
You're good at singing. You're very good at singing.
No, don't make me be Eric.
That's the best way to end it. That's the best way to end it.
I wake up every morning and I say those exact words. On Twitter, Marcin Teodorczyk, Teodorczyk, Kicks. How does this, how would you guys say this?
Why don't you use his handle?
TOSHD over on Twitter gave us, oh, that's not a known. That
is on a rock station.
That is not a known.
TOSHD over on Twitter.
At Black Eyed Lily. Whoa, Black Lily. Wham, wham, whoa, Black Willie.